The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7-9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. This is the morning after the primetime live hearing from the January 6th committee, and we have assembled an all-star cast to discuss this. Normally, it's just Tim Miller and me, but Tim and I will be joined by Bill Kristol and by Sarah Longwell to break down everything that was going on because, I mean, our plate is full. So anyway, thank you all for joining me today.
Hey, Charlie.
Hey there. Hey, Charlie.
All right, so let's start off. I'm just going to throw this out there. What did you think of the hearing? Do you think that it was effective? We'll start with you, Sarah. What was your take on last night?
Yeah, I would say it exceeded my expectations. And I have pretty high expectations of Liz Cheney. You know, I've been doing a lot of media going into the hearings. And the one thing I keep pounding away at is how this will be sort of different from the two impeachments was that they will have Liz Cheney this time. But even she exceeded my expectations because she is so understated and yet searing in her indictment, right? You know, I mean, there's a lot of people who want to kind of set this up as a circus, as a partisan witch hunt. And she literally stops that critique in its tracks with the way that she, both her tone, the crispness and clarity with which she lays out the case. And anytime anyone else is talking, I want them to stop because I only want her to talk.
Okay. Bill, you made the point in the Bulwark today that we can't possibly know whether this is going to move public opinion, but maybe that's not the measure of what happened last night.
I mean, I hope it does. And yeah, it's important if it does, obviously. I just think we don't know it. Less than 24 hours later, we all have people over decades have a record of being bad at predicting what has an effect and what doesn't have an effect and what has an effect on the first day isn't what has an effect. Isn't necessarily what has an effect a month later. We're going to have, I thought one very important thing was the way which Liz Cheney and what was altogether extremely impressive presentation and really one that should make us treasure in a way some aspects of our political system and members of Congress and leaders. We tend to correctly despair in some ways about the people we have in elective office and the way in which our institutions function. But that committee hearing yesterday, I'll just say one word about that, was really an example of our democratic government working. Congress oversight, congressional oversight over something terrible that happened. Unfortunately, one of our two major parties basically didn't cooperate, but thankfully two members of that party did. And the hearing went in an orderly and dignified way. And I think this whole set of hearings, that was what struck me, is that the way Liz Cheney laid it out, will end up cumulatively being more than I would have expected, I guess. I've been talking to some people on the, you know, near the committee and so forth, and sort of had a sense of what they were trying to do. But I think the way in which she kept saying, you will, in hearing number three, you will see that, and you will hear from people, you will see contemporaneous documents, and you will hear from people's sworn testimony. I think she really laid the predicate for the fact that these are the facts. These are the facts. And no one is challenged. I haven't looked at every single person writing about it, but I believe, is there a single challenge anywhere to any factual statement that Liz Cheney made last night?
By the way, I think that's an interesting tell because I am looking for, you know, what the blowback from Conservatism Inc. is, and we'll get to that in a moment. But there appears to be, you know, little effort to refute any of the arguments or the facts. You know, their playbook seems to be, you know, number one, delegitimize the committee, and number two, change the subject, distract, talk about Black Lives Matter being worse or inflation, which is savvy politically, maybe, But it's also an indication that sometimes there are, you know, things that you just simply can't defend. So I want to get your take in a minute, Tim. I actually also had this take that I had pretty high expectations, and also I don't like watching things like this on a normal basis. I was riveted by it, and I was impressed. I was impressed by their willingness to go there when it comes to playing the sound bites of Donald Trump, the juxtaposition of all of it. It was a very methodical case, very unemotional, but had a real kick to it. So, Tim, I wanted to bounce this off you. So the media critics over at CNN were underwhelmed by this. So Oliver Darcy wrote, "We all heard this was going to be a made-for-TV hearing, a presentation designed to capture the attention of the public in a way that normal Capitol Hill events simply do not do." And they hired the TV expert. New York Times, teased that they had hired Goldston to produce the hearings as if they were a docudrama or a must-watch miniseries. But in reality, Darcy writes, the hearing did not feel like a docudrama or must-see miniseries, not even close. Instead, it mostly employed the style of a standard run-of-the-mill Capitol Hill hearing. Yes, there was a haunting video package, but the video, the only real detour from the typical hearing format, only comprised a sliver of the two-hour affair. So bottom line for them was the hearing was not the shock and awe that it needed to be. What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think the theater criticism on this is kind of silly, but I understand where it comes from. I'll just say really briefly on if I could be a theater critic for a second. Yeah. I loved the critic. I thought it was pretty good. I thought Benny Thompson was long at the beginning, and the beginning matters. And so I think there was a little frustration with that. I thought that just splicing in these clips of like Jared Kushner, who like clearly didn't know that was going to be a video that was used or didn't think it was going to be. I thought that was pretty spicy and different from a normal congressional hearing. But here's, I think, what is really underlying that criticism is that because this is not a hearing where like the result of this is going to be people in handcuffs, right? And because the question politically becomes, okay, well, what is the point of this hearing? And then the punditry immediately goes to, well, are we gonna change people's minds? To Bill's point, like, are we gonna change the public's mind? And that is also kind of not the point of this hearing. And I think that everybody has in our brains this little, you know, person that's saying to us, well, is this really going to change the mind of the people who are the cool kid, you know, the cool conservative crowds who are too cool to care about anything on Twitter? Is this really going to change my uncle's mind in the MAGA hat? Is this really going to change any voters' minds who like aren't paying attention? Right. Like, probably not, right? Maybe, I don't know, but probably not. But that, I think, is misdiagnoses why they did this and why we had to do this. Because even if Steven Spielberg had come in and produced this and produced the best, you know, police procedural, or we had your English police procedural, come in and produce the most dramatic thing, that still wasn't going to convince my MAGA uncle. You know, like that. So
well, he wasn't going to be watching anyway. Right.
He wasn't going to be watching anyway. The point of this is really for the accountability, for the government, to Bill's point, to actually look at what happened and present a fully formed factual results and kind of let the chips fall where they may. And I think that there's a certain type of person for whom that is not satisfactory, because they want more, because they think that this was so bad and they want everyone else to realize how bad this was. And I think that impulse is really where this kind of criticism of the presentation comes from.
Well, I generally disagree pretty strongly with Darcy's take, and I usually agree with him, because I actually did think that it was compelling. I thought it was powerful. But I want to ask you about this, Sarah. Maybe it's hard for us particularly to evaluate this because we're too close to it. We've read about it. We've talked about it. We've lived this whole story for the last year and a half. So I would really be interested to hear, what about somebody who's just been sort of casually watching it, not paying attention to all of it? What was their takeaway? Sarah, I mean, what do you think? I mean, I'm thinking of kind of, you know, one of your people from the focus group who may sort of have a reasonably knowledgeable, otherwise they wouldn't have taken up, you know, the time to watch it. Did it strike them as fresh? Did it strike them as revelatory? What do you think? I mean, you wrote in my newsletter this morning that, you know, one of the main takeaways was also that it just kind of rekindled, if you had been watching this or following, it rekindled your rage at what happened and the Republicans. So what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, look, there is a reason that the the cool kids on Twitter, as Tim calls them, are trying to do this kind of nothing to see here, nobody cares about this, because they want that to be true. And look, as a matter of objective analysis, I have been quoted in many places over the last couple of weeks talking about the focus groups and saying, look, January 6th has receded in people's minds and it is a low salience issue for voters. And if you tell people, are you going to vote on January 6th or are you going to vote over how you feel about inflation and gas prices and grocery prices, obviously it is the latter. But none of these Republicans or sort of conservative ink types want to see this become a high salience issue. And while I think it is difficult to make it stick as a high salience issue, what these hearings do is they do elevate it in people's minds. And it reminds everyone, including the people who have spent the last 18 months trying to studiously look away at literally anything else so that they don't have to feel the shame of their cowardice and their choices that both allowed Donald Trump to be president, that allowed him to continue to dominate the Republican Party. Like, I believe that people feel shame in the pits of their stomach over what happened on January 6th and whatever role they played in blocking and tackling for Trump in all those years, the Rich Lowrys, the baseball cranks, the whole crowd at the Washington Examiner. And so the January 6th, to the extent that it refreshes my rage at what Republicans and conservatives will tolerate, because everything that you see happening on the screen is something that has been tolerated by Republicans, 147 of them, after all of that, still came back and refused to certify the election. And this is one of the things that's important that they're prosecuting in this case, which is that everybody knew that Donald Trump was lying about the election being stolen, and yet they all went along with it. And so I think that it, for me, it re-elevates the rage of what these people will tolerate. And I think for a lot of the people who really want to talk about anything else, you know, they want to keep that shame at bay by kind of the distraction game.
I think you're absolutely right, because, you know, as I was watching, I was thinking, how can you see this or think about this and think that this was not a major event? This was not a trivial event. This was not one among other things. And some of the stuff is familiar, but, you know, there's that phrase, you know, it's new to me. If you hadn't seen it before, it was new. And not to, you know, and also at some point you need to remind people of all of that. And so the cool kids on Twitter, you know, Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, saying, well, you know, reactions are predictable to people that you would expect to be outraged or outraged about it. And, well, you know, that's sort of like, I just don't want to deal with this. There is something sort of morally stunted about that.
Yeah, well, boy, morally stunted is a kind way to phrase that. I just wanted to say one thing about the regular people question. And this is going to feel outdated, particularly to, you know, my Not My Party Snapchat crowd, but like being across all of the networks is a different animal as far as just numbers of people that you're reaching with this type of thing. And obviously the clips are going to go around on social media and all that, but you know, on an average, you know, primetime night, you know, you're on network TV, you know, it's over 10 million people that are watching which is orders of magnitude people greater than cable. And so there is, you know, sometimes when we think about your regular person, right, you're thinking about the MAGA hat person or the resistance person. And there are, you know, a lot of gradients out there for people that this does not define their lives, right? And that I do think that there were at least some new eyeballs last night, and that will continue. As far as the, you know, moral, what was our phrase for Rich Lowry? Look, these guys, yeah, the whole point of this is these guys don't have anything to rebut. They don't have anything to rebut. I mean, Andy McCarthy over at National Review, the worst example of this was he literally sends in the same tweet that during the impeachment, I said that they needed to do a more thorough job of investigating and save the impeachment vote for after that was finished. Okay, so that was the first part of the tweet. So, but they rushed that so that it couldn't have been good. Now, we've seen the results of all this, and it doesn't seem like there's anything new. So I don't see what the point of this is either. And it's like, well, and this is just the definition of motivated reasoning. I mean, it was obvious that he should have been convicted at the start, that we didn't need a big investigation. All the evidence was public. And now that we've learned everything, there is actually new information that we've learned from the select committee. So, you know, it's just, they're just grasping for anything to minimize it because just the facts are so ugly.
Yeah. Bill?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think it's absolutely worth doing in its own right. And I think we're very uncertain about whether it has much effect or any effect on the near term politically. Having said that, I think people are being a little too quick to say, oh, well, of course it can have no effect. Look, Sarah's done all these focus groups, but let's see what happens in the next in focus groups 3 or 4 weeks from now. And again, we don't need 50 million Americans to change their mind about the relative importance of inflation and January 6th, or how seriously they rate January 6th and the Republican Party being anti-democracy as an issue. What would make a difference is if 5 or 10% change their minds, or 3%. I mean, if right now, if you talk to sophisticated, I keep telling people, look, it's a 2.2% difference on the generic ballot. It's not so obvious to me it's going to be a blowout election. Oh, no, you don't understand. Democrats or Republicans are all worked up. They've got 72% enthusiasm. Democrats only have 60%. It's always a traditionally bad indicator. And suddenly, what's going to happen? I mean, the enthusiasm question is a bad question. But leaving that aside, what if that 60% goes up to 70% among Democrats? That's only a change at the margin. It's 10% of 35, 45% of the voters, but it can make a heck of a lot of difference in states and districts. And what if a few swing voters decide, geez, I don't know, you know, we can't really put this party back in power. I'm going to just err on the side of the Democrats, even though I'm unhappy about a lot of things. It doesn't take, so I think the kind of complacent, oh my God, this is just never going to make a difference. It's only, it needs to be a difference at the margin. And I'm not so sure it couldn't be.
Well, can I just respond?
Yeah, sure, jump in.
Because Bill is right, although I would say, I would characterize it a little differently, which is part of what's happening right now in terms of the election. To me, it's not about the generic ballot. It's not about just like sort of the a broad shift. What I think it does is it reminds people of something that happened now 18 months ago in a visceral way where you have a bunch of people currently on the ballot in 2022 who were there that day, right? So Doug Mastriano, who is the Republican governor candidate in Pennsylvania, who will appoint the Secretary of the Commonwealth, who probably appoint Kathy Barnett, who was also there on January 6th. What it does is in that, for those voters in Pennsylvania, it elevates in the minds about how bad that was that day and why that guy should not be governor. Carrie Lake in Arizona is very similar, a big January 6th, these people are political prisoners. And so shifting that narrative somewhat actually hurts a lot of the candidates who are running on the very same lie. It is central to their campaigns, running on the same lie that drove the attack that day. And so helping to connect those dots and shift that narrative does matter somewhat.
I agree. And Tim made a point that I don't want to gloss over, that you know, being televised on all of the networks. So let's say, and you guys correct me on the numbers, let's say that 10 million people watched last night. Now that would be relatively low rated, right? And yet that's a hell of a lot more people than watch Fox News on any given day. I mean, that is a much, the what people forget is that these numbers are much, much larger than the cable numbers. We tend to focus on cable television, but that tends to be a rather, you know, small sliver. So I don't know what the ratings are going to be. Second point, you mentioned the connecting the dots. I thought that that was the really strong point of the hearings last night. And Liz Cheney obviously did, you know, did a masterful job of connecting all of those dots. And to the point about the hearings, I thought that, for example, Jamie Raskin did a very good job in the second Trump impeachment, you know, making in his opening remarks in setting the stage for it. And yet you really do see that after more than a year of actual investigation, how much more you have. I mean, this sort of feels like this gets to be a do-over. And it was so much more graphic, so much more vivid. One more point. We mentioned Baseball Crank, who is this master of bad takes over at National Review, Dan McLaughlin. And one of the ways he's spinning this is saying, let me just read his tweet. At the end of the day, either you want Donald Trump to be the main character in American politics, or you want to marginalize him and promote a post-Trump politics. Those of us on the right who want the latter must crawl over the determined resistance of virtually every Democrat. So, you see what they say? You Democrats are making us think about Donald Trump. We want a post-Trump world. And the best way to do that is to what? What? Ignore this? Is to play, talk
you
about.
You could have convicted him. We didn't need last night. They just needed to be 10 more votes. Anyway, that was the thing that was the most enraging for me last night, just watching all this and being like, we could have been done with this. I mean, we still would have needed to have a January 6th committee, but we could have been done with him. Like the ongoing part of this that Amanda has written about so vividly, like there were 43 people, Republicans, many of them who knew better, some of them who were retiring, Rob Portman, and if only 10 of them had just convicted him for this obvious crime that is being laid out so meticulously by Liz Cheney, one in their number, then we wouldn't have to deal with this. We could move on. But you know, Baseball Crank has to figure out a way to make it about about the people who'd want to still talk about this very dangerous person that is leading one of our major political parties.
It's not the Republicans' fault we're beholden to Trump. You're making us do this.
I literally have this in my drafts folder. I tell myself, you should just see my drafts folder because I'm like, do not respond to Baseball Crank. But I have just all these responses in my drafts. But this one is
sure.
It was Democrats who voted to elect Trump. Democrats who absolved him from instigating the attack on the Capitol. It's all Democrats at your publication who justified Trump.
Bastards.
It's the Democrats who run the RNC and put Trump at the center of everything. And then I ran out of characters. It is so preposterous. I cannot, and these people are all like, it's like, you Democrats and you Never Trumpers, you want to keep Trump. As though I don't listen to voters every single week tell me about how important Trump is to them and how he's still at the center of their political universe. And even the ones who don't still like him just fine, didn't think that this was disqualifying. He is not crawling over Democrats. He is crawling over Republican voters who still want this guy in our politics.
Yeah, that's really true. Can I just two quick points? I bet there'll be more than 10 million. Who knows? But 10 million viewers last night with the roadblock across the networks and PBS and two of the three big cables. So we'll see. I mean, and again, what do we always hear? Well, the people who watch cable or on Twitter, they're just intensely involved in politics. They 95% know what they think. But you know what? The people who are watching ABC and CBS and NBC, not as many as they used to be, obviously, somewhat older voters. But they're the ones you have to get to. Well, you know what? A fair number of them watched it last night. So I think people are being a little too quick again to say that, oh, you know, if you're just on Twitter, it's like, well, this is why is last night different from any other night? We're all watching, you know, we're all engaged in the same way. But I don't know if I do think it has a little more chance to penetrate. The other point I would make is, and I guess I said this in my little last night, too. I mean, Nancy Pelosi deserves credit for putting Liz Cheney on the committee and for making her vice chair. That was not an automatic thing that was going to happen. It was slightly controversial, kind of a surprise at the time. And then, of course, there was the McCarthy drama of the people he appointed. And she really did, I think, behind the scenes, also help make sure that it wasn't inevitable that Liz Cheney would give the 25-minute presentation last night. It could have been Jamie Raskin again. And I respect Jamie Raskin, but it would not have had the same effect. And I think that was a Pelosi decision, not just a Benny Thompson or a committee getting together and being collegial decision. And I give Pelosi a lot of credit for her willingness to elevate Liz Cheney in this respect. I think it's been very important that it's been Cheney and not another one of the Democrats doing it, at least last night.
No, I agree completely. And in fact, We talked about this during the second impeachment that, you know, I think maybe they recognized that if they had made it a bipartisan, it might have been, you know, somewhat more effective. It wouldn't have changed the outcome. You know, yeah, clearly Liz Cheney's a boss. I had this thought kept recurring to me, you know, what a dolt Kevin McCarthy is. And I don't know what goes on in his head, probably not a great deal. But his decision not to participate in this committee, to just sulk instead, meant that they were invisible last night. They have no eyes on the committee. They have no role in the committee. If there was a single Trumpist on that committee, they could have, you know, pushed back, tried to rebut, or, you know, just throw dust and smoke, derailed it. Instead, he just gave an open field. I mean, in terms of just classic political malpractice, I thought it was really on display that one of the dumbest political moves is to basically say, yeah, I'm going to give this platform to the other side with no input whatsoever. Real man of political genius, Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah, also just imagine what it looked like. It was supposed to be the Katko Thompson committee, right?
Yeah.
I mean, can you think of a bigger snooze than that? Even if it isn't about rebutting, just the format of it, the way that the hearing went forth, what kind of witnesses, you're killing time, you're having the questions. I completely agree with McCarthy's malpractice. I need to say about Liz Cheney, I know we've done this over and over, but she was just so damn good last night. Texting them and I was thinking back to myself and I feel like this is the one situation where I can put myself in the liberal bulwark audience's shoes, like of a liberal bulwark member who hated all the Republicans. I hated Liz Cheney. She was my least favorite Republican in America when she sold out her sister 12 years ago. And I can remember sitting in my office stewing. I donated to Mike Enzi. I was so mad at her. It's not like he was any better on gays. But it was just, I just needed to do it to get it off my chest. And I was like, to think about the fact that not only would she be my favorite Republican in America, but essentially an American hero and almost the only Republican left I respect. It's just amazing that she's had the gumption to do this. And I really just didn't see it coming at all.
Sarah?
Amanda makes this point in the newsletter because, you know, I'm watching a lot of Republicans who voted for impeachment. They are not trying to highlight that at the moment, right? They are trying to get reelected. Many of them have said sort of bizarre. Peter Meyer, who I like a lot, has said like a couple bizarre things to try to like inch back in the Trumpist direction. And Liz Cheney, going into her reelection when she's down 25 points, knows that being this high profile on this committee does not endear her to the voters of Wyoming. And you know what? She doesn't care. And I got to tell you, watching somebody do something selflessly for the country over their political career, and also, like, we've seen people do it. Like, we saw Jeff Flake do it, but we saw them do it in such an impotent way. They did the right thing, and so I don't want to criticize them, but it all fell flat, right? They were just sort of peeled off one by one. But man, she just sits there and she's goes a warrior. And goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the thing that Liz Cheney did last night is she put the Republicans in the room. They weren't part of it. You know, they weren't there. They weren't on the, but she put them there and called them out on their dishonor. And that was amazing.
And just one more thing really quick on the primacy of this democracy issue and why it's so important. And looking at Meyer and Cheney as a prime example, both of them also voted against my new hobby horse, the bill to raise the gun age to 21 across the board for all guns. And I looked at Meyer and that just infuriated me because Meyer's like a moderate Republican. The notion that he would vote against that on principle is preposterous to me. So he's obviously doing it because he's worried about his right flank. He's worried about his vote. So he's hiding from this committee. He's not doing interviews about how important it is. And he's voting against the gun thing. So I appreciate his vote on impeachment. But just the contrast between that and then Liz Cheney, where in some ways, because Liz has been so stalwart on the defense of democracy, I almost am like, I kind of like that you took that horrible gun vote, right? Because it's just one more piece of evidence that you are a crazy neocon who is just doing the right damn thing.
So Amanda's piece, talks about this, and, she writes, it doesn't matter if Cheney loses her election. She's exposing Trump's 7-part conspiracy to overthrow the election. Without her, there'd be zero accountability. She is bending the arc of history towards justice. And she points out, people lose their congressional seats all the time over much less. Cheney really almost single-handedly, it feels, has willed this congressional committee into action. And so it's worth it. It's 100% worth it. Okay, so guys, I want to take a quick break here. When we come back, I want you to think of the highlight, the moment when you might have stood up and applauded last night. I mean, something that jumped out at you. And again, we are all jaded. We have all paid, we have read about this for a year and a half. And so what was it that really stood out for you last night? And also, we need to debate the question, in the absence of JVL, is Mike Pence a hero? Let's do that right after this. So do you feel like you're living in a media bubble, like it's harder than ever to find views that challenge your own? Well, that's where the Lost Debate steps in. It's a podcast and YouTube show for political eclectics who crave exposure to a diversity of beliefs and perspectives. The Lost Debate covers the latest news, ideas, and trends without the bias and the manipulation from the mainstream or alternative media. It's hosted by Ravi Gupta, a former staffer for Obama and a school principal who fought Republicans at the ballot box, then fought alongside them for charter schools. Also, Corey Bradford, a progressive political organizer turned TikTok star who used to host a Fox News radio show, and Ricky Schlott, a Generation Z New York Post columnist and libertarian fighting to protect free speech. So they come from across the political aisle and from different generations, but they come together for debates that sound less like crossfire and more like discussions between real people. Join the conversation. Check out The Lost Debate today. New episodes drop Tuesdays and Thursdays. Find The Lost Debate on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. Okay, we are back with our mega panel, Bill Kristol, Sarah Longwell, Tim Miller, me, Charlie Sykes. All right, so Tim Miller, what was the high point of, or something that jumped out, it really stood out for you last night? Pick a moment.
Can I just pick two?
Sure. Fine.
Thank you. Well, you know, the rules are tough here. Mm-hmm. I mean, Caroline Edwards' testimony, I'm sure I stole that from Sarah, but it was just obviously so moving. She did such a marvelous job. She was so authentic. And just the notion that she went back into the fight after she got knocked out, knowing that she was overwhelmed by this mob, I was really almost brought to tears by her. And I think that we should build her a statue at the Capitol. On the other side of the coin, getting to watch sniveling Jared Kushner was really also pretty gratifying.
Okay, so Bill Kristol, your moments.
I agree with both of those, but I would just say generally, and I was struck the first time there was a clip from a deposition. I think it wasn't even a, you know, how gripping that is. You know, it just, people can say, well, that's just common. You know, they do that all the time on TV. That's not like fancy TV production, but it is a little different from a typical hearing. And the fact that we're going to see a lot of these now over the next 6 hearings, I think makes it one's interested by Bill Barr sitting at a table with the investigators and sort of just seeing him say it as opposed to someone reading what he has said. And I think that makes the whole thing just more lively and interesting.
Okay. So I actually had the same reaction when they went Bill Barr and then you said, holy crap, there's Ivanka. And then there's the smarmy Jared Kushner, which we could devote an entire podcast to. I thought that the fact that they led with all of these Trump inner circle folks, hey, it's not us, it's not NPR, it's not the New York Times, you know, it's not Bill Kristol and Charlie Sykes and Tim Miller and Sarah Longwell saying this. It is, you know, people, you know, from the heart of MAGA world. I also thought it was extraordinary, their willingness to juxtapose Donald Trump's, you know, comments about, we love you. You are very special people. Moments after watching these absolute barbarian thugs beating the shit out of cops, that tells me that they're going for it. They are going there. So, Sarah, what was your moment that jumped out at you?
Yeah, you know, like they did that 5-minute clip of the rioters actually breaching the Capitol. And I do spontaneously start crying when I see those, because there's whenever we did the previous hearing with the police officers, this happened before as well. Because you're watching the police with these mobs coming at them and they're so scared and you can hear them talking and you can see and you look and they have their guns in their holsters and these people are coming at them saying horrible things. You know, they're bashing through the windows and the fact that the cops did not open fire on them and they took these beatings from them, I always think how different that day would have been if more people had died, like if it had turned into, and so like, there's this part of me that's looking at them being like, you have guns, don't let them overrun you. And then there's this other part of me going, God, thank God they didn't start shooting people. And I don't know what the right thing to do is, whether it was right to be overrun. But the other thing that they did was they had, one of the things I always find confusing about the footage is you can't tell where people are at the Capitol. The Capitol's really big. Mm-hmm. And so where they were showing where they were breaching and then they were interspersing it with the real footage of where they were coming in. I also found that really compelling for the first time. It was helping me visualize where they were coming in and how many different points of entry they were kind of breaking in. And I'll just, that imagery of the being overrun, mobs are so scary, right? Like mobs unleashed are terrifying.
Especially this one.
And so that part stood out to me.
Okay. So this is really interesting because what you just said about the cops and the guns was almost word for word, my wife's reaction, who had the same emotional reaction you did exactly the same moment, and then had the same conversation about what a bloodbath it would have been, you know, if they would have pulled out the guns and they would have shot. I mean, we had exactly that conversation. I also thought one of the highlights was kind of surprising. So when they had the video of the investigator who's walking through the conspiracy, mm-hmm. and the way that they connected Donald Trump telling the Proud Boys, stand back and stand by, and the mm-hmm. impact they had had, and then seeing them and the little video clips of what was one of those guys, I can't remember which one, on Alex Jones, you know, talking about how it's going to be bloody. I thought one of the highlights was, you know, Steve Bannon predicting, you know, how wild and extraordinary it was going to be. Putting all of these things together, they weren't afraid to use things from social media, from videos and all of this. And you really do start to get the ugly, dark side of this conspiracy. And one of the things that kept coming through my mind is how can anyone watch or listen to any of this and think this was just a peaceful protest, or these were just tourists, or they actually used Donald Trump's quote about you could feel the love in the air. Like, you know, I mean, how delusional do you have to be? So no wonder Baseball Crank and Rich Lowry are going, hey, nothing to see here. No, just don't pay any attention. Because if you do pay attention, it is impossible to say that, you know, this is in any way remotely acceptable, or it's not a really big fucking deal.
Don't you think, Charlie, that in Republic, maybe we were talking about earlier about the effect of this. I think one effect could be also in Republican donor world and Republican conservative elite world, whatever they say publicly, to be a little more forward leaning after this November in thinking about, but maybe even doing a little bit. I know that's a stretch to not have Trump as the Republican nominee in 24. They've got to look at that and think, this guy cannot be the actual nominee of the party. We can all not criticize him. We could all suck up to him. We could all be Dave McCormick-like and pretend he's a fine fellow and there's a slight aberration on January 6th. But I wonder, to the degree, if you're Ron DeSantis watching last night, you might be more inclined to actually run against Trump in 2024 instead of deferring, I think. Who knows? But and God knows you shouldn't bet too much on the courage or even the clarity of thought of Republican donors and conservative elites and members of Congress and so forth, the state chairs. But I got to think there's a little bit more hesitation in that world about, it's one thing not to take them on. It's one thing to be like Liz Cheney and actually tell the truth. It's another thing to actually think about in September 2024 and having to make the case that this guy should be president again. That bridge is a little longer than it was maybe a few weeks ago.
I think so too.
On the one hand, I agree with that. I agree with that instinct. That's a natural human instinct. On the other hand, I'm going to take one of your pet issues, Bill, to offer the counterpoint, which is if this was proof that the quote unquote responsible types, you know, might start to act differently, wouldn't we have seen some of that at News Corp last night? Yeah. Our old friend Paul Ryan on the board of News Corp. Paul Ryan, I loved that he was lecturing the lack of courage among the Congress people that didn't vote to convict. I agreed. That was a good point. It was, you know, deeply unself-aware, but a good point. Not only, I don't know if people miss this, I think it's worth just really calling out. Not only did Fox not air the hearing last night, but Tucker got rid of commercials. Tucker went a full 60 minutes last night without commercials, you know, to avoid people flipping over during the commercial break. I mean, that is astounding that they went. Maybe there was some FCC reason, you know, because the other networks weren't doing commercials. I don't know. But, you know, for that to happen and them not to explain it, you know, not to even do the token, okay, we're going to cut in with Brett Baer for 10 minutes, you know, or whatever. Deeply depressing.
Well, very much on brand for them. Okay, so let's have this debate about Mike Pence, because he clearly is central to this narrative. That was another one of my takeaways, is how pivotal Mike Pence's role was in all of this. The uber ultra Trumpist loyalist who spent 4 years being a sycophant stood up to Donald Trump, didn't go along despite the real pressure. And by the way, that was well done, where they juxtaposed the attacks by Trump on Pence and then his tweet and then the people saying, hang Mike Pence. That I thought was very, very well done. Our colleague Jonathan Lass wrote a piece for The Atlantic saying that Mike Pence is a hero. We ought to regard, the Democrats ought to treat him like a hero. So let's discuss this in JVL's absence. Sarah Longwell, Mike Pence hero or not? By the way, I'm just going to say that in JVL's absence, I'm going to take the JVL position on this, just so you know. So his position will be represented. But Sarah, what do you think?
I think that hero is a term we should reserve for, as Tim mentioned, like the cops who were there at the Capitol, who after getting knocked unconscious, went back, joined the line again, and then started treating people who'd been sprayed with bear spray. That's the definition of a hero. Mm-hmm. What Mike Pence did was his sworn duty. He met his obligation. And anybody who knows JVL knows that JVL doesn't really think Mike Pence is a hero. His tongue is somewhere in his cheek as he wrote that, because part of what he's trying to demonstrate is how much Republican voters think that Mike Pence is a traitor. This is something I hear in focus groups all the time, the idea that Mike Pence didn't stand with Donald Trump And, you know, I think central to the case that this committee is going to make is, what did Donald Trump do for those 187 minutes? And as people shouted, you know, hang Mike Pence, something he is reported to have said is, you know, maybe they should hang Mike Pence. Maybe they're right about Mike Pence. And so I think that JVL's point is more that one should elevate him in service to, because it's so crazy. Like Mike Pence, they were chanting it. And yet Mike Pence, he has given like one speech where he has said that what happened that day was wrong, that Donald Trump was wrong. But he's not doing what Liz Cheney is doing. And that's the thing about Liz Cheney. She sets a bar by which you can judge everybody else. Liz Cheney's a hero. Mike Pence met his constitutional obligation that day as he ought to have. It is good that he did. He probably did preserve a very important piece of the republic by doing it. But hero is too strong a term.
Okay, we've heard the phrase defining deviancy down. Maybe we are defining heroism down, but these are the times we live in. So where do you come down on this issue, Bill?
I think JVL was, yes, making more the point that Democrats should say Mike Pence is a hero. Or in fact, doesn't he actually suggest that Speaker Pelosi should just put a resolution on the floor of the House praising Mike Pence just for his actions that day? They don't have to get into anything else he did for 4 years. It would be a fun, it would be a fun resolution. I guess I don't know how many Democratic votes, honestly, they would even get for that, but she'd have to whip it pretty hard. But it would be kind of a nice way of, but look, I think the politics behind this remain important. I was talking to a Democrat this morning who said, there are some Republican voters who will be a little bit like, geez, Mike Pence and Bill Barr and General Milley and his own campaign people telling him it was lost, and Republicans and Fox News hosts calling to tell him to call off the mob on January 6th. All of that could add up. So it's not my cup of tea, so to speak. I'm with Liz Cheney, not with Mike Pence and Bill Barr. But I think there is some political utility, honestly, to emphasizing what they said in real time to Donald Trump. Donald Trump knew he lost. Donald Trump knew that he was subverting the law. Donald Trump knew that he was inciting the mob. All those things were, he knew them. His own colleagues told him that. He saw it in real time and he did it.
Tim?
Well, we all have clunkers in life, Charlie. And, you know, JVL is just churning out a great newsletter every day. Almost all A's, B's in there. This one was a gutter ball for me. I received even a text from a non-political friend asking, was a little concerned about, about my colleague. I don't think that person got the subtext. So I'll just, you know, we'll just let that be for JVL. I will say this. And this might be something that I'm going to work on over the weekend, so it's not a fully developed thought. But I think that Mike Pence does have a chance to actually be a hero if he'd finished the job. And I'm pretty disappointed. Disappointed is maybe the wrong word. But the fact that he's not testifying in front of this committee leaves me very little sympathy for Mike Pence in particular. And like, if he finished the job, if he would, you know, I feel like we're at these movies, right? You know, it's a cliche in movies where the good guy is, they're going down into the fire, and it's like, you got to drop him into the fire. You know, you can't give him an opportunity to get back out again. If you want to be the hero, you know, you have to finish the job. And it doesn't seem like Mike Pence wants to finish the job.
All right, that is a good point. And if in fact he ends up not cooperating with this committee, then, you know, then he's undermined himself. And he has done that. I mean, he has backed off from some of the things that he said. You know, one of the great moments, defining moments of his life, rather than doubling down on it, sometimes he wants to downplay it, which I think is unfortunate. On the other hand, I think of incidents of, you know, when I was growing up, there was actually a TV version of John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. And I remember watching all of that. And I'm thinking, you know, if you were writing a Profiles in Courage, and I know how this grates on people. I mean, obviously, Liz Cheney would be at the top of any list. But what Mike Pence did by resisting that pressure is so extraordinary, especially when you think of all the other Republicans that have caved in. All of the other Republicans who looked the other way, who kept silent, who went along with all of it. And how history would have been completely different if Mike Pence would have done basically what Mike Pence did for the last 4 years, which was to do whatever Donald Trump, you know, asked him to do. And so the fact that he did put, you know, his sworn duty ahead of politics may seem like a bare minimum, but it's not a bare minimum in 2021, 2022 anymore. at the moment, when you think of the role of people that you may not like Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger, or you know, Doug Ducey in Arizona and Mike Pence, I mean, the history would have been a lot different if they would have just done what 90% of other Republicans are doing. So I guess I'm willing to come down on the side that Mike Pence certainly comes off looking a lot better after last night. I don't know whether I'd call him a hero, but I'm willing to go along with it. Hey, by the way, Tim, can I just tell you something?
Please.
Okay. So just how the world, you know, works here. I am actually looking at Twitter right now, and I'm looking at tweets that are...
You're podcasting and tweeting at the same time? You're multitasking?
No, I'm reading. I'm not actually tweeting. I can't actually do that, although I have. I'm looking at, under notifications.
Yeah.
I wish I could give you a screenshot of it. Tim Miller and Mia Farrow retweeted a tweet you were mentioned in.
Oh.
Which is Amanda Carpenter's. So I have the picture of Tim Miller and Mia.
I was hoping for like Timmy Chalamet or, Harry Styles. But no, Mia Farrow's fine, I guess.
Okay, just so you know, there is this moment where, you know, the planets have aligned. All right, so... Tim, since we're talking about this, you had a piece for The Bulwark yesterday afternoon about the gun issue, which we have gone over and over and over again. There's been all kinds of wish casting about, well, this time is going to be different because we're going to have a compromise. And yet we're finding out that when it actually comes down to it, even the most benign pieces of legislation, like, for example, raising the minimum age for purchasing assault rifles to 21, you had only a handful of Republicans in the House. And you wrote about Senator John Cornyn, who for the last week has kind of been the quote unquote reasonable Republican, and he's killing this proposal. So just give me your thoughts about this and where we're at on an issue that you want to talk about enraging. I am constantly enraged about this issue, but go ahead.
Yeah, so I wrote about this yesterday. I just felt like we needed to get it up there on the record because he went out of the way to leak to the Daily Caller that... you know, to sort of signal to the base, don't worry, we're not going to be taking any guns away, and explicitly said that the 21 age limit increase was off the table. And, you know, in a day of the January 6th hearings, I thought this is going to get lost. And Chris Murphy, God love him, is doing anything, and he's bending over backwards. I think that they'd probably do the stupid door control if that's what it took, right? Just to get anything that might help actually impact these mass shootings, and the Republicans, it's just Lucy with the football all over again. So I think that maybe they'll do the red flag law incentives and some money for school security, which is literally the bare minimum that you could do. It's like the Mike Pence of gun reform, and so it's like, okay, well, that's fine, I guess. I'm not going to give them a heroism award, but I'll give them, you know, a check mark on their report card like Mike Pence gets for doing his job. But the fact that they can't do this is obviously just an unbelievable abdication of their duty, but I do think it is an opportunity for Democrats, and it's a thing to campaign on, and that was really the point of the article, is that 21 cannot just get lumped in with all of the other various gun issues, because it's visceral, it's something you can run ads on, it's something that makes the Republicans look stupid, it's very hard to defend, right? Like, why can my kid get an assault rifle but not a White Claw? And it's very hard to defend on a debate stage if you're a deft Democratic debater, and there's going to be some stupid Republicans on the debate stage this fall. So I just don't want the Democratic strategists to just let this one pass by, and that's the point of writing it. Just one quick thing, you're multitasking, I'm also multitasking while potting. I got a text from your Bulwark guest, Ryan Bussey, on this, and he had just read the article and said that there's one thing, a behind the scenes thing about why it got pulled, is that the NRA and the other gun rights groups do not want any legislation that will bifurcate certain types of rifles from other types of rifles, right? And so this notion that you can't move everything to 21 because, you know, you don't want to ban a kid or an 18-year-old in Arkansas from getting, you know, one of those old falutin rifles that only have one bullet in them to kill the varmint. So since you don't want to make that 21, they don't want anything that separates out assault rifles, because that then is kind of giving into this talking point that there is actually a difference in the type of rifle. And that is, according to Bussey, what is behind why Cornyn killed that.
So, Sarah, I was really struck by something that was in one of your focus groups that you tweeted out, that you were talking to a group of conservatives. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. I'm doing this from memory. Of Republican voters from Florida. And none of them seem to have a problem with raising the age to 21. So this is not a wedge issue.
No, I think that this was 2020 Trump voters in Florida. We asked about guns. This was a week or so ago. So after Uvalde. And it was interesting because they did talk about some of the standard things that you hear Republicans talk about. They talked about mental health. They talked about hardening security in schools. But they also were just completely firm that the age should be 21. Many of them thought it should be 25. And they thought that it should be harder to get a gun. And some of them were gun owners themselves. And so I just think that there is a very common sense part of people. And this is where Tim's right about, you know, some of these show votes that the Democrats do saying, well, we want to get the Republicans on the record. They're not good enough to run on. But this issue is good enough to run on. And Democrats should not fail to prosecute this case as part of the broader case with abortion and with January 6th, with all of it about how extreme Republicans are.
No, I agree. In fact, my experience has been among conservative gun owners who tend to vote Republican that when it comes to this issue of raising the age, people don't have a problem with it. I mean, this is one where there is kind of the reality check that the NRA is not actually speaking for tens of millions of voters. So, Bill, you can comment on this if you like, but I wanted to ask you a question. So right before we did this podcast, I had an interview, a SiriusXM show from Canada, where they're constantly going, what is going on with you Americans? Just like, okay, I don't have all the answers for you. But she asked me, so today, how are you feeling about the state of American democracy? What are you? And my answer was, I sort of hedged it. I said, I'm nervous still. I'm really struck by how vulnerable it is. But your take, because you, I sense in your contribution today that you have at least a glimmer of more optimism.
I mean,
possibly,
yeah. And in this sense, look, I think on the whole, it's a bad news story. That is to say, if you had told us all on January 7th, 2021, that this is where we'd be in terms of the Republican Party conservative movement, it's worse than we would have thought. There was a moment where we could have perhaps, in a way, put a parenthesis around the Trump years and begun to recover from it. And we would still have had huge issues with the way the Republican Party had behaved over those years and so forth. But so that didn't happen. So that's bad news. And I think that is the biggest piece of news, unfortunately. On the other hand, there's been a bit of a counter trend, I think one could say, over the last maybe over recent weeks and months, and maybe the hearing will accelerate that, which is if you look at the actual, and this is sort of Sarah's point, I think if you look at state by state, I think the chances of having governors and secretaries of state who will stand for democracy in 2024 is probably greater than we might have thought 2 or 3 months ago in the depths of despair. The chances of Democrats, in my opinion, holding the Senate actually are greater than I would have thought 3, 4 months ago. I think maybe a little better than 50-50 at this point because of some of the character of these Republican candidates. So, I think that in that respect, yes, I'm a little more optimistic, a little more sense that Trump, I was talking with one Republican who's in the field doing polling and involved in a couple of campaigns. And Trump seems a little weaker than he was. And God knows that's not a solution to everything because there's a post-Trump authoritarianism that in some ways could be even more scarier than Trump. But I think in the short, medium term, it weakens the authoritarians if there are fissures and divisions there. So, yes, I think some green shoots perhaps in the otherwise the slough of despair. Is that how you pronounce that? I don't know, whatever.
Yes.
The slough of despond.
Slough, what is it? A slough, slough? I never knew what it is. Yeah.
No, okay. my mother says that.
No, it was your Kenyan education.
Isn't your mother British though? Are we sure that isn't?
Yeah, maybe that's kind of British like pronunciation.
Yeah.
If you guys want to impugn my mother, fine.
No, I'm just saying maybe that's not the American pronunciation. That's all.
Leave mothers out. See, you know, part of the my problem is that I really want to, you know, have that same, you know, look for the green shoots, and I do occasionally find the green shoots. And then you wake up on a morning and you go, you know, the country feels like it's having a nervous breakdown. When you see the kinds of the prospects of violence, and this again, you know, kept coming back. You know, you saw how violent January 6th was. The fact that you have a guy who is, you know, traveling across the country to murder a Supreme Court justice. Right. We had a judge in Wisconsin who was killed. You know, I do think that we have perhaps been lucky that we haven't had more overt violence like this. But, you know, it's like, how many red flags do we need? We have this incredibly angry country bristling with guns. you know, can we be shocked if things really begin to fall apart? And I don't want to be that negative, but I guess my anxiety is that how will Americans respond to all of this? Because it's being laid out for them. Are we going to go through that feeling of January 7th? Because you mentioned, you know, that there was a moment we could have moved on from this. I mean, the pivotal moment was January 7th when everybody said, you know, Donald Trump is an absolute disgrace. People were quitting the White House. They were quitting his cabinet. Republicans were bailing all over the place. And Sarah, as my recollection is, that lasted about 5 minutes. You know, as Tim mentioned before, Republicans had the perfect opportunity to put Trump behind them. They just had to vote on the impeachment and they chose not to. And so we've seen this again and again and again. And so between the rise of violence and the, you know, unwillingness to face the facts and the fact that you've had opportunities to move past it and you haven't done it in the past. So where do you come down on this? How do you feel about American democracy this morning?
Yeah, well, look, I'm always going to be long on America and American democracy, but I am very short on the Republican Party. Okay. And I do think that there really is only one solution, which is you have to defeat every last one of these guys. And I think the main problem in our politics, the thing that I worry about, is that we have one party that is completely insane, lost its mind, has no shame. And then we have another party that is insufficiently popular to defeat that other party. And I don't like the blaming Democrats for what Republicans do, but I will blame Democrats for what Democrats don't do, which is seize this moment and try to become the big, broad pro-democracy coalition that can defeat the Republican Party. But I'll say, when I think about green shoots, we can end where we started, which is the orderly, sober way that hearing went last night. As Bill pointed out, that is what democracy looks like. It is a bipartisan committee. Yeah. It is a thing that gives me hope watching them do it. It was not a circus. It was not a partisan witch hunt. And I think it was effective at reminding people of what good governance in the United States looks like. And I'm glad we're going to have five more of these.
Can we end on a positive note? Because we rarely are able to do that. So
comment was not going to be positive. So let's just end.
I knew that. See, I'm thinking now Tim's going to come and he's going to rain on us. So, and by the way, just a quick programming note, Tim will be hosting the podcast on Monday and he's got a very interesting guest. So Tim, just give us a short thumbnail of Monday's podcast.
My old friend, Jamie Kirchick, has been working on a book for almost a decade. It's called The Secret City. It's a history of gays in Washington. And it is phenomenal. I'm not one for fake praise, as you all know. It is. It goes from basically, it's like a Forrest Gump look at the gay person that was in the picture at every major historical event from FDR all the way up to Clinton. It is interesting, riveting. You'll learn new things about history. You'll become depressed about all the homophobia and bigotry of our leaders over the past few decades, but they're also heroes that you don't know about. So it's an interesting interview. We do a little bit of politics too, and I think everybody will enjoy it. A little break from the day-to-day nonsense.
No, well, I could use a break, and I'm very grateful for giving me Monday off. So make sure you tune in to Tim Miller hosting Monday's podcast. And once again, thank you, Bill Kristol. Thank you, Sarah Longwell. Thank you, Tim Miller, for joining me on today's podcast. Hey, gang, I just wanted to drop in to say thank you for joining me here each weekday. And also, I want to give a shout out to our Bulwark Plus members who helped underwrite this show and keep everything we do at the Bulwark sustainable. You might think that a Bulwark Plus membership is all about our newsletters like my daily morning shots, but really, Bulwark Plus membership is about a lot more than that. We're building a community of independent-minded, concerned patriots who value democracy and the truth. We make most of what we do free and accessible by everybody because you can't help save democracy from behind a paywall, but we do have some great member-only benefits that I'd like to share with you. Because in addition to our newsletters, members have commenting privileges and also have access to ad-free versions of this show and all of the podcasts in the Bulwark Network, like Sarah Longwell's Focus Group podcast and Mona Charon's show, Beg to Differ. And there's the Thursday Night Bulwark, a live video broadcast that we host for members each week on Zoom. You can give Bulwark Plus membership a try for the next 30 days for free. Simply go to thebulwark.com/Charlie to claim your free trial today. That's thebulwark.com/Charlie. Thanks.
The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio production by Jonathan Siri.
I'm Charlie Sykes. Thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast, and we'll be back tomorrow to do this all over again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.